Hey, welcome to an episode of Crippled by Culture, where we talk about everything in life and relate it to the disability and chronically ill community. My name is Sean Gold, and I'm an author, advocate, and nonverbal public speaker for the disability community. To provide a quick visual description for accessibility, I'm a Black man with a white tracheostomy breathing tube in my neck. I'm wearing a red and black shirt, and the person off camera is who you hear speaking for me. This video is of a Zoom call with me and the person talking for me off camera, and my guest is in the other box next to mine. Today, I would like to thank Adam Ross for being my voice in this episode. In this episode, we are talking about the intersections of disability, racism within our community, ableism in the medical field, and disability justice.
Before we get any further into the interview, I want to give a shout out to our partnering nonprofit festival for the series, Festability. As a board member, I helped put together a wonderful event in St. Louis at the Missouri History Museum. We will have so many activities and vendors set up all over with an amazing headliner for our main stage. This year, I will be opening for Tony Award-winning actress Ali Stroker. Festability is the best event in St. Louis to celebrate your disability unapologetically. Make sure you come out later this year on October 7, 2023 from 11 a.m. to 5 p.m. Thank you, Festability, for sponsoring the series. Now, back to the show.
Now, let's get to today's amazing guest, who happens to be one of my best friends. Mary Fashik is a Lebanese-born queer disability rights activist, author, public speaker, and workshop facilitator. She founded Upgrade Accessibility in 2019, a social justice movement designed to challenge today's accessibility standards. Since its inception, the movement has grown and broadened its lens to include disability rights and disability justice, with a focus on intersectionality and equity. Through a variety of workshops and trainings, Mary helps companies understand how deeply rooted ableism is in their organizational structure and how to implement important changes. In 2021, she was named an honoree on DiverseAbility's D30 Disability Impact List, where she now works as their community engagement manager. She is also the creator and host of the Politics of Disability podcast, which was chosen as Best Interview Podcast at the 2022 Astoria Film Festival. Mary, thank you for being here today. How are you doing?
Hi, Sean. Thank you so much for having me on your show today. My name is Mary Fashik. My pronouns are she, her, and a breakable description is I'm a Lebanese woman with short dark curly hair, wearing glasses, black headphones, speaking into a black microphone, and wearing a multicolored sweater today because as we are recording this, it is very cold in Georgia today. And I am coming to you from my home office. It has white walls and art of Marilyn Monroe on the walls, and I'm so excited to be here with you today. So thank you for having me.
Thank you so much, Mary. I'm excited you're here, and I really appreciate the visual description. So we'll go ahead and get started. This seems to be a silly question to ask after your intro, but we're going to stick to the script. Do you identify with having a disability or chronic illness?
Yes. So I identify as being both disabled and chronically ill. I have cerebral palsy. I've had cerebral palsy since birth. I was not officially diagnosed with cerebral palsy until the age of 2. And then as far as my chronic illnesses, I did not get diagnosed with chronic illness until I was 40, and I'm currently 45 years old. And it took a long time. I know we'll get into the medical racism part of the delayed diagnosis later on in the interview. But yes, I do identify as both.
And how does your disability and chronic illnesses, how do they affect your everyday life?
So I want to say that with my cerebral palsy until recently, it's kind of weird to say I got used to being disabled, but it didn't impact me on a daily basis as much as my chronic illnesses do. With my chronic illnesses, I have constant fatigue, and I have days where I wake up and within 2 hours of being awake, I need to go back to sleep because I just cannot function. The lack of cognitive and executive function is something that I struggle with on a daily basis, and all of that is due to my chronic illnesses. And with my disability with cerebral palsy, I always say if I have an acute injury, like I have broken my foot before, I feel more affected by those than I do by my cerebral palsy. But with my cerebral palsy came arthritis when I hit 30. And that is one of the things that I think about, especially on days like today when it's very cold and my joints hurt and I can't move as quickly. And also, as I'm getting older with my cerebral palsy, I'm becoming less ambulatory. I'm not able to stand even assisted for long periods of time anymore. So that's really hard to come to terms with, that my cerebral palsy as I'm getting older is affecting me more day by day.
Yeah, thank you for sharing that. And that really just highlights, how much nuance and dynamics goes into various disability and chronic illness experiences, where it's not just one thing necessarily, but it's something that is non-static over time. It changes over time, ebbs and flows, and there's just a lot of dynamics to it. So thank you for illustrating that. And do you feel that there are any other things going on that you feel are not diagnosed?
Oh, I know that I have like many undiagnosed chronic illnesses, because getting a diagnosis is a privilege, and having access to care in order to get those diagnoses is also a privilege. And it's a privilege I don't have. I live in Brunswick. Brunswick is a very rural area. We have one cardiologist, and we have one rheumatologist, and one specialist, maybe two. I can give you a very brief example. I went to a gastroenterologist here in town, and it's the only gastroenterologist that will take my insurance. And he disagreed with my rheumatologist about my lupus diagnosis. So I went to the rheumatologist. He diagnosed me with lupus. I knew I had lupus. I had known for over a year by my own research that I have lupus. My doctor did genetic testing, and I have lupus. I go to the gastroenterologist, and the gastroenterologist says, "I don't believe you have lupus. I want you to get a second opinion." But there are no other rheumatologists here in Brunswick. So what did he want me to do? He wants me to go to Atlanta, which is 4 to 4.5 hours each way. Now, that would mean, and this was prior to the pandemic, that would mean someone with chronic fatigue would have to drive 4 hours one way, and then have a doctor's appointment, stay overnight, and drive back home the next day. Because I would have to go with my roommate. My roommate has to take time off work. And it's a whole big thing. And now, because I did not see and get the second opinion from the other rheumatologist, the gastroenterologist refuses to see me. He won't treat me now. So I am quote unquote allowed to see the gastroenterologist PA. And when I tried to go see her, when I had an appointment with her, at that time, I had developed my gluten allergy. I'm extremely, extremely allergic to gluten. If I have one crumb of gluten, I get very, very ill. And when I told her about my gluten allergy, she looked at me and said, "Who told you you have a gluten allergy?" And I said, "My body." "My body told me I had a gluten allergy. Yes, who told me I had a gluten allergy?" So I think I have many comorbidities that go along with lupus. One being hypermobile erythema syndrome. My rheumatologist at the time had mentioned that he believed I had hypermobile EDS, but when I went back to him for a follow-up and asked him about an official diagnosis, he said, "Oh no, we're not going to do that testing because it's too expensive." So he told me I had a condition. I know I have a condition. I do not have a formal diagnosis. And there are things like POTS, mast cell activation syndrome. All of these are comorbidities, and I have symptoms of all of them. So I know that there are other conditions that I don't have formal diagnosis for.
Okay. So, yeah, you talked about a lot there. There's the, let me actually just compose myself a second here. Just a moment. Yeah, so first of all, I just want to say, I hate that you have had to experience that. And I hate that that is the experience of so many disabled and chronically ill people dealing with not only individual doctors and practitioners who are not granting us the agency in our medical decisions that we deserve and that we need, but also the kinds of things that many people may run into in different parts of the country due to, you know, just the difference in distribution of how many doctors may be in an area and how that causes limitations as well for people and for you in your everyday life and in your real life. So these things are, definitely, they all come together to create this experience where we have to become experts. you know, like you pointed out how your body told you, you know, and so often that is invalidated. So I just want to, you know, honor that. And yeah, so thank you for sharing that. And is lupus a type of cancer?
No, lupus is an autoimmune disorder, and it affects your entire body. I can't begin to describe what it does. It causes, so it's like a ripple effect, because it affects one part of your body, which affects another part of your body, which affects another part of your body. So, yeah, it just, you know, it's an autoimmune, and for me, it was just when I looked things up, I was like, oh, I have this. And also, I forgot to mention fibromyalgia. So let me tell you my fibromyalgia story. So that was the very first thing I got diagnosed with, was fibromyalgia. I should say that, because that was my PA, my general practitioner PA, who diagnosed me with fibromyalgia. Because when I went to her and I said, look, something is off. I don't, like, I knew something was horribly wrong. And I remember sitting in Panera, again, this is before my gluten allergy. I'm sitting in Panera with my roommate, my best friend, and we're talking about fibromyalgia. And with fibromyalgia, you have points on your body where if you touch them, they just hurt very, very badly. And I remember sitting in Panera with her and her poking me in the arm and poking me, going, "Is this hurt?" And I'm in the middle of Panera going, "Ow, ow." So, you know, like, yes, that hurt. And that's how we figured out I have fibromyalgia, even before I was officially diagnosed with fibromyalgia, was sitting there in the middle of Panera being poked at by my best friend. So, yeah, I have several autoimmune disorders. And like I said, there's a lot of comorbidities. So comorbidities, like, they're like partners, right? They go hand in hand with each other. So chances are, if you have Ehlers-Danlos syndrome, you have POTS. If you have POTS, you have mast cell activation syndrome. It's kind of like this whole domino ripple effect. So that's what lupus is. And there are different types of lupus. Mine is SLE. That's the type that I have.
Thank you. I just learned something new. And I think many people in the audience will as well. So thank you for that. And kind of going back to the idea of ableism that we experience, did you also have to go through your own internalized ableism, and how has that journey been towards inner and acceptance?
So, as far as like internalized ableism for which my disability was so public, I had a ton of it, you know, because like when I was growing up in the 80s and 90s, and yes, I'm old. We were taught like that we had to be better than our non-disabled counterparts, right? We have to do more. And that still carry over to my age today, where I feel like I have to do more, be better. But as I got more involved in advocacy, I have learned to work through my internalized ableism. It hasn't been easy. As far as my chronic illness, I think that's where the internal ableism hit me the hardest, and also imposter syndrome. Like, I felt like, oh, well, I haven't been sick that long, so, you know, I don't fit into the spoony chronic illness circle. But in actuality, I have been sick for a long time. I just have not been diagnosed for very long. But many of my conditions are genetic. So that means I've had them this whole time. I just didn't know about them. So it's feeling as though I have the right to speak on issues that affect the chronic illness community. And that is something that I have been wanting to do over the past 4 years, almost 5 years now. And it's been difficult, and it's been difficult to get through that ableism, that internal ableism. And still, to this day, you know, like, I hear myself talk, and that is, like, the worst thing. I hate hearing my speech because of how I sound. I can't stand it. But then I hear so many people tell me, we want to hear you talk. We want to hear you speak. It's important that you speak. And I think I've told you this before, but, like, that's why I won't, if I make a TikTok video, I don't speak in any of my TikTok videos because I am, like, so afraid of what people will say about me, about my speech, because I have mocked and made fun of for years because of the way I speak. So I'm still hesitant. Podcast, public speaking, work engagements, you name it, but I'm still hesitant to even speak when making a TikTok video.
You don't speak, and I don't understand why.
Because I'm so afraid of what people will think when I open my mouth. Like, like, I can fit into the TikTok culture by the videos I make and not speaking. I'm afraid that if I speak, that will, I just cannot, that's the internalized ableism. I cannot get over the fear of doing that.
Yeah. Do you think that we ever get to a point where we've 100% overcome or rid ourselves of internalized ableism? Do you think that's possible?
Oh, no, never. And that's because we have ableist society putting these standards on us and these expectations and saying these things about us. And the lack of understanding about disability. So no, I think that we can learn to navigate it in the best way possible, but are we ever going to rid ourselves of it? Never, never.
Yeah, that makes sense because we're still getting the inputs. We're still getting that communication from society. From institutions and individuals, yeah.
Exactly, like, because we are continually getting these messages, it's like when you cut yourself, right? If you cut yourself and you're bleeding and you take care of the cut, you put something on it and you cover it, it's gonna heal and it's gonna go away, right? But we ableism, it's like this cut that never heals, this wound that never heals, this wound that just keeps getting reopened or pouring salt in this wound continually. So it will never heal and it will never go away just because of that.
Yeah, like, swimming against a current. And then also with that part of me, the other part of me is saying, well, bitch, get over it. I mute myself because I breathe like a walrus dying. Get over it, right?
But it's hard. It's hard to get over it, right? It's so hard. Like, I'm happy that you are living your youth at a time where disability justice is so dark and so front and center. I am so thankful that you are a thought leader, you are a change maker, and you are young, and you are living in a time where the disability community is saying, this is what we think, and if you don't like it, too bad. I did not grow up in my late teens and early 20s in that time. We were expected to perform and live up to ableist norms. And I still carry that now in my 40s. So I'm thankful that you are able to move forward and you are leading the next generation of disability activists. All I'm trying to do is make sure that the ground is a little bit smoother for all of you to come after me.
I am so grateful for you. Thank you so much, Mary. And yeah, that's a very human thing that you pointed out, just that, you know, the landscape of disability justice has changed so much with social media and the position that non-disabled people were put in because of the pandemic as well. So it's very human to still kind of have that ingrained, because it's a survival skill, right?
It is 100% a survival skill, because it's either I want to defend myself or disabled society is going to consume me. And I got to a point in my life where I said, I am not going to let this society consume me. And I honestly think it was a pandemic, and realizing that COVID could kill me, and I was not going to let these selfish, non-disabled people kill me. I just was not going to do that. And I think that's when I was like, okay, either this is going to consume me, or I'm going to move forward, and I'm going to be that person that people, every time I walk in the room, I'll be like, oh, here we go again. Like, here she is. And like, yeah, here I am. Here I am.
Very that. Exactly that. Here I am. And something that I just thought of when you were talking about just the sort of space that you were in when you started your advocacy journey. So you began Upgrade Accessibility in 2019. Why was that important for you to do?
No, I continually tell the story, and I always say that, you know, famous people have the story about when they were discovered. Well, this is my story about how I started Upgrade Accessibility, and my roommate / best friend gets to be the highlight of the story. So I always tell her, I will always talk about her, because this is the origin story of Upgrade Accessibility. In August of 2018, I was in a local grocery store before the pandemic. I was in a local grocery store with my best friend, went to use the bathroom. I am a wheelchair user. I am an ambulatory wheelchair user. What does that mean? I can take some steps assisted. If I'm holding on, I'm able to do that. So I went to use the accessible stall. My motorized wheelchair barely fit in that stall, the armrest was right up against the door. So I barely had any room to transfer onto the commode from my chair. And I come out of that bathroom and I look at her and I said, who decides what in the hell is accessible? And I said, it's non-disabled people deciding this. And I said, accessibility is an upgrade. I was like, I'm going to start a hashtag, right? Because in 2018, that's what you did. Right? If you went viral, you went viral because you started this hashtag, right? That was like the year of hashtag. So my best friend being my best friend that she is and being skeptical about everything said to me, well, you have to make sure that nobody has a hashtag. So I went home, nobody had a hashtag. I took a picture, literally took a picture when I was in this doll. So I said, I'm posting this on social media. I'm posting this on Instagram. I go home, I start the hashtag, I started to post about different things that were inaccessible around Brunswick. And, you know, life got in the way as it does, right? Life happened. So nothing really happened with the hashtag. It didn't really take off the way I wanted it to. I didn't have that many followers. And then in December of that year, so now we are 4 years out from what I'm about to tell you. 4 years ago, I have friends that came down to visit. They were staying overnight. I go out to dinner with them. And again, I can transfer into a booth or whatever. And long story short, my access needs were denied. And because of that, I fell and I was injured. And I now have permanent injury to my wrist and my hip and my knee on top of my disability, on top of my chronic illness, all because of my access needs being denied. And what was my access need that was denied? The server waiting 3 minutes for me to transfer from my wheelchair into a booth. Just because of that, I now have permanent damage in my joints. On my dominant side, mind you. My injuries took almost a year to heal. That happened in December of 2018. I took all of my anger. It happened right before Christmas. Actually, I think tomorrow will be the 4-year anniversary if I'm thinking about it. I took all of that anger and I said, I'm going to make this a movement. It is no longer going to be a hashtag. It is now a movement. And we are going to talk about how these accessibility standards are as low as can be. And I get what you did, Sean, how you started to just ask people, hey, can I interview you? Can I talk to you? I would DM people. I would DM people like Nina Kame and other people like that and be like, hi, I want to talk about like what is accessibility on your end of the world like or your end of the country like. What, like, can you answer these questions for me? And I would post these short little interviews on Instagram. And that's how it got started. But as you know, accessibility is not just physical access. It's like accessing, it's captioning, it's visual description, all of that. And as I did my advocacy, I grew and I learned. And then Black Lives Matter, and then the pandemic. And then I realized something in the mix of all of that. I'm a brown woman, right? I'm a brown woman. And I'm just dark enough Mind you, I'm not as dark as I was prior to the pandemic because I've been home. I've been in my house. So I'm not going out. I'm not getting the sun that I used to get. So my melanin is not where it used to be, right? But at the time, I realized that I am just brown enough in Brunswick, Georgia, that white people around me know that I'm not white. And people are starting to treat me like I'm not white. And I realized, oh, and then everything with Ahmaud Arbery happened. My roommate worked with Ahmaud Arbery's mother. That's how small Brunswick is. And I started to understand, and I always understood, but I shifted my focus on talking about accessibility and disability justice. Because, you know, one of the things I always say is there cannot be collective liberation, true collective liberation, unless we include the disabled and chronic ill community. And it has to be the most marginalized of the disabled and chronic ill community. And that was a very long-winded answer. I'm really sorry about that.
No, thank you. I loved it. That was very insightful. And that inspired a question about accessibility, disability justice, and disability rights. These are words that the audience may be familiar with, but they're also words that some people use interchangeably. How do they overlap and how do they differ?
Okay, well, it's like a Venn diagram, right? So they all overlap in the center and then they all have their individual things. So accessibility can be physical access, can be providing image descriptions, video descriptions, all of that. Disability rights is saying, I have a right to equal pay. Disability justice is ensuring that I have the right to equal pay as a disabled person. So disability justice ensures that our disability rights are enforced. Disability rights, being able to have more than $2,000 in assets in the bank. Disability justice is being a policy maker, a change maker, to make sure that that can happen. So that's where all of those three intersect, but they're all different at the same time.
Thank you. Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. And it's sounding like disability justice being something that you've come to focus on more and more, it's also sounding like disability justice is perhaps the more comprehensive of the three?
It definitely is, and it's definitely something that has now is the root of my advocacy and guides my advocacy is disability justice. And if you don't understand disability justice, you're not going to understand disability rights or accessibility.
So have you made a great accessibility in LLC yet?
Well, that's a big question. If I was going to make a great accessibility anything, it would be a 501(c), which is a nonprofit. I have thought about it. It's a lot of work. And I don't know, being that I am a one-woman show, I don't know if I could handle that yet. That is something that I want to maybe do down the line. I want to work with other disability nonprofits first and garner some experience before I even attempt to do that.
That makes sense. That makes a lot of sense. And whatever you do it, you know, I'm going to be there supporting you. So what has surprised you, or what have you learned about advocating as you got more used to and more experienced at being one?
That when you are the loudest voice in the room, and I don't mean being verbal, but how I mean when you are bold, that makes people uncomfortable. But I always say, if I have upset somebody today, if I have made somebody mad for something that I said, then I did my job for the day. And that is something that I have learned. I am tired of being gaslit by non-disabled people telling me that things are no big deal. Things are not a big deal for you, maybe, because you are not in my shoes. You cannot deal with the inequities that I deal with every single day. So I'm going to be loud, I'm going to be bold, and I'm going to make you uncomfortable.
Period. So we are not going to bullshit this interview. I'm going to ask straightforward. What are the most noticeable differences between white disabled advocates versus seasoned disabled advocates? Please go completely off.
Okay, so I said this to you before. We probably should specify what you mean by seasoned advocates. I know you mean non-white advocates. So I will say this, in all seriousness, the fundamental difference is privilege. An acknowledgement of privilege. White disabled people have privilege, and I am sick and tired of white disabled advocates acting as though they are the victims in all of us when they have privilege over me, over you, over so many. Now, that being said, I am brown. I have privilege over you. I acknowledge my privilege. I always acknowledge my privilege. Yes, I am multi-marginalized, but I am multi-marginalized with privilege. And I acknowledge that. And my goal is to amplify those who are the most multi-marginalized in our community. And the fact that white disabled advocates think that it's okay to steal people's work and not give them credit and steal work as though it's their own work. And then people think it's like the most amazing thing when I honestly said that 3 days ago and got nasty DMs for it. But a white disabled advocate and say it, and oh, it's the best thing they've ever heard. And it's like, I'm not here to be palatable. And white disabled advocates are palatable. That's what people gravitate to. They gravitate towards palatability. Guess what? I'm not here to be palatable. I am not vanilla pudding that you eat when you're sick. No, that's not me. I'm not here to make you feel better. I'm gonna make you think about things that you don't want to think about, and I'm gonna bring up the uncomfortable topics that nobody else will bring up. And I do want to say one thing about this topic. There are a couple of white disabled advocates who talk about sexual things. And body positivity and all that. And the ones that I'm talking about are extremely problematic, extremely toxic. And yet our community excuses them because they're talking about something that no one else talks about. Well, I could talk about being a sexual being if I wanted to, but that's not my goal with my advocacy. And it's time that we stop uplifting problematic disabled white advocates. We have to stop that. We have to stop giving them the audience and stop giving them the platform that they have. You wanted me to go off? There you go. I went off.
Yes, thank you. And to the non-disabled people who are not trying to take the information in, I want you to feel horrible about yourself. I don't care about protecting feelings because then I'm not doing my job. So yeah, honestly, I could not have said it better. You took the words right out of my brain. Yeah, and would you say that we are even fighting for the same inclusion, or are white disabled people broadly just wanting to achieve their full white privileges? Or does it depend on the person?
I don't want to generalize, right? Because I think that's a problem as well, is when we generalize, right? Yeah. But I don't think a white disabled woman is gonna understand what I went through, going to a clinic for women, a women's health clinic that was for low income and impoverished women, and guess who was there? Majority black and brown women, and the way I was treated at that clinic. The fact that I was left to hemorrhage from a burst cyst on my ovary, that they left me 5 days to just bleed and not check in with me, and I could have gone septic and died. I don't know if a white disabled woman would have that experience. Maybe she would just because she's a disabled woman. And women's health are people who birth, right? Birthing bodies, white birthing bodies don't have the privilege as non-white birthing, as non-disabled birthing bodies. So someone who is disabled and has a birthing body versus someone who is not disabled and has a birthing body are treated differently. So maybe the white disabled woman would have had the same experience, or maybe not. So I can't say, you know, but I will say this, do they fight medical racism? No, they don't. So while we are fighting for some of the same things, there are things that they will never understand what it is like fighting for. I hope that makes sense.
Yeah, no, that made total sense. And, you know, thank you for pointing out, like, there's nuances to privilege and marginalization. You know, there's nuances inherent to an intersectional lens. And it's helpful for us to develop that lens because generalizations don't really capture the full picture. Yeah. And so besides the pandemic, how often have you experienced medical ableism? I know that you spoke just about one experience and then another one earlier as well. So how often would you say?
So let's talk about medical and racism. Let's talk about medical racism. Let's go there and then we'll tie into ableism, because ableism and racism, we both know, are tied together, right? So, when I first moved to Brunswick, well, a few years after I moved to Brunswick, I had a doctor who was a white man, a non-disabled white man, cisgender, in his 30s. And I was not feeling well. And he diagnosed me with hypothyroidism. And I got put, which means your thyroid is like kind of sluggish and not doing what it's supposed to be doing. So I got put on medication to regulate my thyroid. That helped for a little while. But then that fatigue that I mentioned earlier got really bad. And I went to him and I said, something is wrong. I don't feel well. Something is wrong. And he said, look at me, Sean. And he said to me, oh, you're getting older. I was not even 40 yet. I was in my 30s. And he told me, oh, you're getting older. Oh, it's just your cerebral palsy. Oh, it's you're just depressed. And I'm thinking, I know that this is not right. And then he sent me to an endocrinologist. They're the ones that deal more specifically with your thyroid and things like that. He sent me to this endocrinologist. And I don't know if I can tell this story without getting very emotional. But I went to the endocrinologist, and here's where the ableism came in. Not necessarily the racism, but the ableism. I met with his intern, and his intern was a Latinx young woman. I remember her very well. And she took off. She listened to everything I said, right? Because she was another brown woman like me. And she listened to me. And I remember her saying, okay, I'm going to go tell the doctor what we talk about, and we'll be in to see you. So I'm sitting in the room, and I can hear him talking in the hallway. And I can hear the doctor say, there's nothing wrong with her. There's nothing I can do for her. There's nothing wrong with her. And he came in the room and he told me my lab test was fine and basically made me feel that I had lost all of my senses, that I didn't know what I was talking about. And I came home and I sat in the living room and I said to my roommate, I said, what if I'm dying and nobody knows? And nobody cares. And once you know, it took 8 years after that for me to get my first chronic illness diagnosis. And, you know, this is just a little snippet of what I have gone through here in this rural town, but I know people in bigger cities go through it also. And it's just, and also, like, if I bring along my roommate to an appointment because I'm tired that day, I'm not able to really get my thoughts together, and I need someone to help me make sure I don't forget something to tell the doctor, they will speak to her instead of speaking to me. And they'll ask her, how was she feeling today? And I'm like, I'm right here. Why are you like, she doesn't know how I feel today. Like, she may know a little bit because I might have told her on the way to the appointment, but she's not in my body. She doesn't know my aches and pains or my pain level or anything like that. And it's just so frustrating that. And then I have to mention, talking about medical racism, I do have to tell this story about Well, I have to tell a story, and this is medical racism and ableism all rolled into one, about the rheumatologist that I spoke about earlier. My rheumatologist was a brown man, okay? He was Middle Eastern like I am. And because of the part of the Middle East he was from, where he's from, and where I'm from, the countries don't necessarily get along. And when he found out where I was from, he said, "Oh, I shouldn't like you, or that gives me reason not to like you." And he laughed about it. And I'm like, this man just discriminated against me because I'm from a part of the world that his country does not like. Which I was just floored by that. And this is the same man that prescribed me medication. And he wanted me to titrate up on this medication. And if people don't know what that means, it means you are supposed to gradually increase your dose of medicine. So he told me to titrate up on this medicine that was supposed to help with my lupus. And I started the medicine and I started to feel sick. And as I'm titrating up on this med, I'm getting sicker and sicker and sicker, unable to eat anything. And when I do, I can't keep it down. And I'm starting to be in tremendous pain. And when I called the nurse to tell her what was going on, the nurse talked to the doctor, and she come back and told me, "Oh, he wants you to hang in there a little bit longer so you get used to the med." So I continue to get sicker. Sean, I put on a pair of shorts because my roommate and I were going to go on vacation. I put on a pair of shorts. When I put them on the week before vacation, they were snug. They fit me, but they were kind of snug. I took them with me. We went on vacation the next week, and the shorts fell off of me. That is how much weight I lost within 1 week from being on this medication. I laid in our hotel room in our bed, and I was shaking so violently because this medicine like made me so cold, made me so sick, that I was shaking the entire bed. This is how sick I was. This man almost killed me. But of course, you know, people want to say there's no medical ableism or no medical racism.
What the fuck? Like, yeah, maybe they haven't experienced any medical racism or ableism. Oh, but they're definitely doing their thing. And it's so infuriating that you have experienced that. And it really just shows like medical ableism and racism are not only, you know, physically harmful and medically harmful, but they can also be very psychologically harmful. So much that even, you know, months or years after an incident happens in a medical setting, you know, these are things that we still have to worry about, and these are still things that affect us, understandably, because it's very traumatic.
I definitely, yeah, compounded my, I have PTSD, and I just compounded my PTSD. I mean, every time I think about, like, you know, what happened and how I almost died, and I'm just being so sick. And to this day, I have nights where I still sick so bad. In the summer, I have to sleep under blankets. It gets to be, and at night here, it can be in the 80s, and I'm still sleeping under blankets because the medicine that he put me on just regulated my body just that badly.
Okay, guys, here's the thing. Mary's interview went on for nearly 2 hours, so it's too long to put in one episode. But that is why she is getting a two-part episode. Please stay tuned for the rest of this conversation as it is so important. All of her links will be in the description section of both parts. Until then, thank you for watching and listening. Make sure you like, comment all your thoughts, and subscribe. Also, make sure that bell is on as well. I'll see you all next time on the second half of this episode of Crippled by Culture.